Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
It is so nice to begin another show on this beautiful day. And last week we talked about fascism.
Right.
And are we finishing that up today?
Or we're moving on to the events.
That's right.
What was happening, what was motivated. Once we have an understanding of what's in the minds of these people, then we can see as they take over government in Germany and then actually begin to apply those theories to reality and the result of that.
Okay.
So we're going to jump right in and say that Adolf Hitler was invited to become the Chancellor of Germany on January 30th, 1933.
He was invited.
He was invited. I said that specifically because the fact of the matter is that he was never elected.
Uh-huh.
The only chance that the German people had to elect him to public office, they refused. In 1932, during the presidential election, he ran against Paul von Hindenburg, the 84-year-old senile veteran of the First World War, and lost. So the German people actually preferred an old, senile old man to this young, upcoming politician.
That says a lot about what they thought of him already.
Yeah. But unfortunately, other politicians felt that they could control him. There's a whole series of misunderstandings and misrepresentations. And one of those who felt that he could be controlled was the Catholic politician Franz von Papen. And Franz von Papen believed, and after there was a series of short governments, they just could not get a majority in the Reichstag, in the German parliament. And so von Papen went to President Hindenburg and said, I think if we bring Hitler into the government, we can control him. We've got a majority, we've got a larger group. The Christian Democrats is a larger group. The National Socialist Party is relatively small. It's just been beaten in this past election. It has had a surge in some of the local elections, and so if we were to combine the two together in a coalition government, we could go ahead and possibly stabilize the German government. Now, that's very important because remember that they're in the middle of the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was, and people were willing to take risky steps in order to do something about this terrible depression. Now, Hitler agreed to come into the government, but only if he would be chancellor. Von Papen didn't see a problem with that because he was going to be the vice chancellor.
Okay.
There were a couple other positions that Hitler wanted in the cabinet, but they weren't important positions, seemingly. Like, for instance, the foreign secretary would not be a Nazi. The defense ministry would not be. So what he asked for was, you know, he wanted one of his own to be the minister for the interior for the state of Prussia. Now, you know, here in the United States, when we talk about the Secretary of the Interior, we're thinking about, you know, Smokey the Bear, national parks, that kind of stuff. But the Minister of the Interior in most European countries also controls the state police. And once again, here in the United States, we think of state police, you know, they're basically the friendly guys who are out helping you, or at the worst, they're trying to catch you speeding on a highway. You know, in Europe, their position is much more powerful and insidious. And so he succeeded in getting one of his own, Hermann Göring, placed then as the Minister for the Interior for the state of Prussia. Now, Prussia is an important state because the city of Berlin, the capital, is in Prussia. Events happen, flow very, very rapidly. He takes over on January 30th. On February 27th, less than a month later, the Reichstag, the parliament building, is burned down, is gutted. And, of course, it's going to be the police who are going to do the investigation, and, of course, they're going to they're going to come to the conclusion that this was a communist plot, and that Hitler announces that there is an attempted overthrow of the government. There is a coup that is underway, that the burning of the Reichstag was simply the first act of this, and that the communists were trying to take over Germany. And with that, he arrested some 4,000 communists, made raids on their party headquarters, arrested communists, and pulled them into every jail, every prison he could. And in the end, they're not going to have enough. And so they're going to have to actually create special camps to hold these people. They're going to concentrate them. Therefore, you have concentration camps. He goes to the parliament and he asks for an emergency decree to take care of the state, to preserve the state against this communist revolution, and he's given those powers. Okay. With that, the concentration camps are set up. With that, the police then go further and end up ultimately arresting 10,000. Most of them are communists or communist sympathizers. He goes back to Parliament again and says, okay, we're in the process of getting this thing under control, but I need emergency powers. I need to have powers that will suspend the Constitution for 4 years.
Oh, my God.
You know? And these are powers that will suspend the civil rights of German citizens. People can be arrested and held without without charges, without trial. Okay? And that's very scary stuff. It's called the Enabling Acts.
Yeah.
But also keep in mind, I mean, this is very contemporary in a sense also, because after the September 11th attacks, we've taken some very strident steps in our own country with the Patriot Act, the suspension of habeas corpus in a few cases, the establishment of a camp in Guantanamo Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And those people who are there are not going to receive the same judicial rights that we...
war criminals.
Yeah, that we work under. So there are times when extraordinary times call for extraordinary acts. And certainly, if you get yourself into the mindset of German politicians in 1933, I'm not talking Nazi politicians,
mm-hmm.
but for instance, Christian Democrats, they're going to make those kind of concessions, not knowing what's coming down the road.
Right. It's easy for us to look back.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And you know, and then you will always say, well, it can't happen here. Well, they said it couldn't happen there.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens then is that you have bringing together two of the parties in Parliament. You have the Christian Democrats, called the Center Party at the time, allying itself with the National Socialist Party and voting against the Communist Party of Germany, the KPD, okay? Removing them from Parliament so that you have the solid majority. The fact of the matter is that, you know, in 1937, when the 4 years were up, nobody said, oh, by the way, your 4 years are up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It is really within a year that Germany is absolutely changed. And by June of 1934, everybody understands that this is no longer a constitutional government. It's not going to go back to a constitutional government. It is now a dictatorship. And the reason why June 1934 is so important is that's the month that Hitler turned on his own. And what happened here, it's called the Night of the Long Knives. Inside of Germany, as in every country, you have certain constituencies. And Hitler is gathering these constituencies to himself. And one of those that he relies on very heavily is a group within the Nazi Party called the Brown Shirts, or the SA, the Sturmabteilung. And this group is led by a rather despicable character by the name of Ernst Röhm. And Röhm, personally, he's just revulsive. But he is also power-hungry. He has this huge following of men dressed in these brown shirts who are basically the muscle behind the National Socialists. They go out and they beat up people. They're the ones that had fought in the streets with communist thugs. They're just basically thugs. They're Nazi thugs. And what happens is that Hitler is really concerned that this Ernst Röhm is becoming more and more powerful. Even with Hitler now being Chancellor of Germany, the entire German army is only 100,000 men. And now he's beginning to fudge on that, but it's still relatively small. Röhm has several hundred thousand men. And so in order to decapitate this potential threat, on one night, Hitler orders the SS, these are the black shirts under Heinrich Himmler, and it's a much smaller group, to go all throughout Germany and to raid all the leaders of the SA and to arrest them or to kill them. And in this one night, in a gangland style, people are just taken off and murdered. Röhm himself is hauled off and taken to a prison. And he demands to see the Führer. And they said, that's not going to happen. And what they did was they handed him a revolver with one shot. And they said, either you do it or we're going to do it. And he killed himself.
Wow.
With that, Germany enters into nothing less than a reign of terror. Terror on itself. The government itself is the source of terror in Germany. There are organizations that are set up specifically in order to bring this terror to the people. You have, for instance, the one that I just alluded to earlier on, Hermann Göring, using the secret state police. The term for that in German is Geheime Staatspolizei. We take the first part of each of those words, Geheime Staatspolizei, Gestapo. And that's how that's where the word Gestapo comes from. So that's the secret state police. These are guys who they're the ones that are wearing the leather trench coats. Okay. Then you've got the SS itself. These are the black shirts, and these are the guys that had done the dirty deed on the night of the long knives. They're under the leadership of Heinrich Himmler. And after the SA is put down, the SS will grow very rapidly, and it'll have a lot of. It becomes, in a sense, a country in its own. It's a law all unto itself, and the SS will be given great authority to do many of the dirty deeds that are done later on. Particularly, the whole Holocaust itself is going to the managers of that will be the SS. The camps themselves will be run by the SS. They'll even have an armed element of that that's serving within the army called the Waffen-SS. Okay. And it's a unit in the German army, but it's independent of the army leadership itself. And then there's another group called the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst. And what this is basically it's a political police. And this is led by Reinhard Heydrich. And their job was to stop people from committing crime before they had a chance to commit the crime. So what they did was they're really thought police. They're going to catch people who are thinking about committing a crime. Mm. I was talking about this the other day to some of the seminarians, and they reminded me that there was a movie came out just a year or two ago with Tom Cruise called... Minority Report, I think it was. Or
yeah, it sounds. Yeah. I didn't see it, but it sounds familiar.
Yeah, but it's sort of a thought police kind of a thing.
Okay.
So in those years, in 1933, 1934, in a relatively short period of time, Hitler then is beginning to gather these constituencies that would be his support. The army, 100,000 strong. But now what he's doing is he's encouraging the army to grow. Now, that's a violation of the Versailles Treaty, but he will, over time, violate that treaty time after time after time. And the League of Nations, or France, or Belgium, or Britain, simply didn't have the gumption, the courage, the guts to stand up to him in his violations and just, you know, draw a line in the sand. They simply didn't do that. The United States was absolutely isolationist at this point. And just ignoring the growing storm. Mm-hmm. But the loyal to the army was there. because he was building the army back again. He was giving pride to the army, and he was also demanding of the officers of the army a loyalty oath, not to Germany, not to the Constitution, not to President Hindenburg, but to him personally. And he got away with it. They did it. The unions were, for all practical purposes, closed. The trade unions were incorporated into big business. And the very idea of a strike in Nazi Germany became absolutely impossible. You had big business itself was pretty happy with the way things were going. Actually, when you look around, there was only one element that he did not control after the night of the Long Knives, when he had total control over his own party, and that's the churches. And the one element within the churches that he had less control over than any of the others was the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. because it's an international body. And in two areas, the Catholic Church made its presence felt, and one was in its own rights. The right to have Catholic education, the right to have youth organizations, you know, those sorts of things. And that was guaranteed through the Concordat of 1933, which is roundly condemned. But understand that, you know, Pius XI was making concordats, as we said the other day, mm-hmm. with lots of unsavory characters, with the intention of trying to preserve some turf within those countries so that he could critique the worst deeds of that country. With Hitler, it's simply not going to work. You know, let that for what it's worth. But rights, there was going to be a contest over that. And then also some moral positions, as we'll see with the euthanasia campaign, that the church will speak out and have an influence in Nazi Germany. But quite honestly, not many people had much influence with Nazi Germany. It's set up in such a way that individuals and groups are not able to effectively move policy. That's just a reality. From the beginning, the church found itself embroiled with the Nazis, whether they liked it or not, and it was relatively innocuous. The embroilment came over genealogy. You know, genealogy is pretty much of a pastime. It's a hobby. Some people are into it. Other people aren't. I know some priests, when they answer the door and there's a genealogist standing there, like, would you please go away? I want to make communion calls, you know. But others, like myself, who have done genealogical work, appreciate anyone who's willing to help them with mm-hmm. sources. There's a reason why the Nazis were into genealogy, and that was in order to prove their Aryan past. And so they hired genealogists, they hired historians to help them with these. And I've seen these, it's called an Ahnenpass. It's quite an elaborate genealogical pedigree. And the problem is that in Germany, that there were government records that only went back, national records, back to 1875, because mm-hmm. Germany was only founded as a country in 1871. So you don't have a lot of good government records. Some of the states had archives with genealogical records that went back as early as, maybe 1810, 1812, something like that. And that's really because of French influence from the French Revolution. But if you wanted to have records that went back before 1810, you had to go to the churches, the baptismal records. And so they would help out with that and help give those genealogical records. In some of the organizations, to be a member of the National Socialist Party, you had to have some kind of a pedigree. But to be an SS member, you had to trace your ancestry back to 1750 or before.
Wow.
And the only way to do that is through church records. Now, here you have a couple problems. One of the problems that you begin dealing with is first of all, a harassment of Jews. There's going to be a definite, clear separation between the Jewish population of Germany and the others in Germany. And that's certainly something that Hitler wanted from the very beginning. He spoke of it in Mein Kampf. He spoke way before he became chancellor, of this concept of the Entfernung, of the final separating of Jews from Germans. So that's going to be part of this. Another problem that they're going to have to deal with is called the Mischling problem. And Mischling means mixed. And the fact of the matter is that after centuries and centuries of German non-Jews living with German Jews, that unless you're dealing with Orthodox Jews, in many cases there's intermarriage that takes place. Families intermarry, and there's a natural ebb and flow. And so there are, by the 1930s, there are a good number of Germans who can look to their grandparents and find Jewish grandparents and maybe Catholic or Lutheran grandparents, and that's just a reality too. So that's going to be a situation. Even in the early 1930s, there are groups that are set up to help Christian Jews, if you could say that, to emigrate from Germany. In fact, in the 1930s, one organization called the St. Raphael Verein, the St. Raphael's Union, sponsored some 2,000 immigrants in order to leave Germany to go to another country. Everything comes to a head. Again, it's a night thing called the Night of the Broken Glass. This is in the mid-1930s when there is an organized pogrom against Jews all throughout Germany. The burning of scores of synagogues, the destruction of hundreds of Jewish shops and Jewish homes, beating up of all kinds of people. And after that, it becomes perfectly clear that Germany is a dangerous place for Jews to be in. If they didn't catch it with the rhetoric and the propaganda, they certainly knew it now.
Mm-hmm.
And this all plays into the official German policy regarding Jews in the 1930s, which was leave. Mm-hmm. Get out of here. You're not welcome here anymore. And many Jews caught the idea and did move. Many of them moved to countries that were contiguous to Germany, clearly understanding that this thing will pass. It's going mm-hmm. to blow over. Mm-hmm. I mean, for centuries, Jews had had problems with pogroms and attacks against them, and they've weathered that storm. And certainly, once again, if you get into the mindset of the people themselves, they've got to be thinking, well, this is bad, but it's not the worst it's ever been. And you know, Hitler needs us, you know. we have expertise. We have know-how. Why would he do this? Well, they're sorely underestimating the just the hatred that this man has deep in his soul. You know, mm-hmm. There's a real problem then for some. There are 28,000 Mischlinge Catholics in Germany, mm-hmm. and the big question is, what's going to happen to these? You know. The bishops are incredibly naive in retrospect. Looking at it from their point of view, if you're not going to do Monday morning quarterbacking, you'd have to say, well, it seems to make sense at that point. But in retrospect, we look back and go, oh, I can't believe this. One bishop in Cologne wrote to the German government and said, I'm concerned about all of these Jewish Catholics who have been picked up and have been arrested and they've been sent off to concentration camps. I'm concerned about that. Are Mass and the sacraments available for them? There was another bishop of another diocese that wrote to the government and said, I'm concerned for my people. There are so many that have been arrested because they're Jewish, but they're Catholic, and they're being sent to these concentration camps. Can you assure me that they'll be okay, and would you promise to separate them from the non-Jewish Christians for fear that they might be beaten up by Jews? Whoa. There was even a suggestion on the part of some of the bishops that they go through their diocesan records to find any priest that had Jewish ancestry and ask these priests to volunteer to go to the concentration camps to minister to the Mischlinge. Isn't that naive?
Wow.
But at the same time, you know, you have to understand the mindset.
Right.
You know. It's only with time that you're going to have clashes between the Hitler Youth and basically the CYOs and the CYCs. There's just a wonderful story. I spent a summer in Bavaria reading in the archives of the Brothers of the Christian Schools and interviewing Christian brothers about their experience during the 1930s and 1940s. And they are very proud of one old brother. And I don't remember what city he was in, but he was teaching in basically a German high school, a gymnasium. And several of his students had joined the Hitler Youth. And they came into school wearing the Hitler Youth uniform. And there was a little problem for a while about not wearing the school uniform, wearing this uniform. But ultimately, the administration of the school backed down and said, okay, you can wear the Hitler Youth uniform. And but what these kids were doing was they were spying on their teachers. Mm. And this particular brother had no affection for the Nazis and would make comments every once in a while. But one of the things he did not do at the beginning of class was begin class by everyone standing up and giving the Hitler greeting, you know, the Sieg Heil greeting with the outstretched arm. And he never did that. And so some of his students reported him to the local Gauleiter or whatever. And sure enough, the police came and he was questioned. And a day or two later, he was questioned again and actually hauled off for multiple hour interrogation down at the police station. And late that night, the police brought him by the brother's residence and dropped him off. And the next morning, everyone was waiting to see what he was going to do. And so he called the students to stand, and all the students stood up. And you can imagine the scene where you have all these students and maybe a half dozen young boys there dressed in Hitler uniforms waiting to get the Hitler greeting, you know, Sieg Heil. And what the brother did, here he is standing with that long black robe and the white ribbon, and he goes out. It's hard to do on radio, but imagine this. He takes his right hand and he stretches it out like as if he was going to give the Hitler greeting. And when he does this, instead of saying Sieg Heil or Heil Hitler, what he said was, he said, In Name des Vaters und des Sohnes und des Heiligen Geistes, he went ahead and gave the sign of the cross. And then he just glared at those Hitler kids and he says, sit down. And he went on with class. Well, you can imagine after school, they all went and reported him. Mm-hmm. You know what? The police never came back. It was like they just didn't want to handle this guy. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a lesson for us there. Maybe if more people had done that. But anyway, mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's another story that I had come across in which a priest was needed a plumber. And while the man was doing his working in the kitchen or whatever, the priest gave a little joke, a little Hitler joke, making fun of Hitler. And he was just trying to make light talk with this guy. Turns out he was a party member. Mm. And he reported the priest, and the priest was hauled off that night and spent a year in a concentration camp.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is not fun.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't volunteer for that position.
Yeah, no. So that's the first policy of the National Socialist government in Germany, is to expel, to get Jews to leave. Ultimately, that is not going to work because, especially after the Anschluss, in which Germany invaded in a friendly invasion of Austria. Once again, many Austrian Jews as well as German Jews were rounded up. And then, of course, after 1939, with the World War II breaking out, all of the early German victories brought them large numbers of Jews. In Poland, 3 million alone. And so expelling them was not going to work. So the second then phase of the German process of dealing with the Jewish populations was to concentrate them. And so now, instead of sending them away, now it would be a question of taking their stuff, taking everything they owned, and then putting them onto cattle cars and bringing them to concentration camps. Okay. Now, I have to tell you, this was not fun. These were terrible experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, as time went on, the Nazis who ran these camps would make a fine science out of torturing people. And, I mean, even to the point of regulating the number of calories they had in a day, and then to make sure they worked in excess of that in forced labor with the intention of literally weakening people so that their bodies were eating themselves. This was done scientifically. Mm-hmm. I'm not even talking about the medical experiments and all the other things that went on. And I'm not talking about the death camps themselves. That's a later experience. But the concentration camps concentrated people together and denied them of any kind of human dignity. So that's taking place. And it's taking place inside of Germany. And German people are aware that people are being concentrated into these camps. These camps are not only filled with Jews, but they're also filled with communists, those guys who were left over from before. They're filled with dissenters. People are saying, hey, wait, I said, what are you doing here? Where's the Constitution? They're in there. They're filled with criminals. It turned out to be cheaper to put them in the concentration camps rather than the prisons. And so the criminals are sent into these camps. These criminals are really good. You know, I mean, they're very clever they're streetwise, and so the Nazis will use them as basically foremen. They're called capos, and they'll actually run the camps.
Okay.
You know, for the Nazis, you're going to have deviants, moral deviants, even alcoholics. You know, if you're a town drunk and you're disruptive, they'll send you off to a concentration camp, and that's a fine way to sober up, you know. Mm-hmm. Homosexuals, gypsies, just all kinds of what are you, the Bibelfolgen, Jehovah's Witnesses.
Oh.
If you're a Jehovah's Witness, you'd be sent to a concentration camp. Later on, when the war is underway, particularly Dachau is going to have an incredibly huge number of Polish religious priests and religious brothers that were going to be there. But I don't want to move too fast on this, because there's a whole other campaign that's underway that shows us also not just the racism of National Socialism, but the whole denigration of human dignity. Okay, mm-hmm. And that is just that really reveals itself in the euthanasia campaign of 1941. This has been planned for years. There were Illuminati within the Nazi Party that had been urging Hitler to do this, and basically the idea would be to eliminate the what Alfred Rosenberg, the philosopher of National Socialism, refers to as the useless eaters. All those people in Germany who were not producing, who were not productive, would then be quietly eliminated. And the way, and this would be across the board, it would empty out insane asylums, mentally handicapped, terminally ill. And the definition of that was quite broad. I mean, it included diabetics.
Wow.
You know, epileptics. So it was a very broad definition. It's as early as 1939, in September of 1939, that Hitler sent an order to two men. One of those was Philipp Böhler. His rank was a Reichsleiter, and then also a doctor by the name of Karl Brandt. And the order itself said the following: that they were given the responsibility of enlarging the authority of certain physicians to be designated by name in such a manner that persons who, according to human judgment, are incurable, can upon a careful diagnosis of their condition of sickness be accorded a mercy death.
Wow.
Now, one of the things we see here is the beautiful use of language in covering the actual horrors that are going to go on. You know, be accorded a mercy death. Thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah, right.
And then, you know, a careful diagnosis of the conditions of the illness. That doesn't happen. We'll talk about that. And you know, that there's some kind of a panel of medical experts that are going to do this. The two of them set up an organization that comes to be known as T4. And it's named after the address that the office is in Berlin. It's Tiergartenstrasse 4. Okay, and the organization's title is National Coordinating Agency for therapeutic and medical establishments.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds pretty innocuous, you know. It's sort of the same euphemisms that we have today, don't we? I mean, you know, with like women's health clinic.
Yeah, right.
You know,
exactly.
We know
mm-hmm.
what that is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our hope clinic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hope for what? You know. It hides the actual truth of what's going on. In order to then coordinate these groups, and there were about six of these establishments that were designated throughout Germany, the most insidious of which was Hadamar in central Germany. They had to find a way to transport people to these centers, and so they established another company called the Charitable Foundation for Institutional Care. And this foundation had buses, organized the leasing of trains, and those sorts of things. There would be six centers set up for the treating of patients.
Treating.
Yeah. In December of 1940, the method which was used previous to this, which was shooting, was changed over to carbon monoxide. I'll say something more of that a little bit later. But a couple years ago, Cardinal Ratzinger gave an interview about his own family past. And I'd just like to read you a couple little sections of this, because he himself had the experience of the euthanasia campaign as a boy in his own village. He said, and this, the article goes like this. It says, in a speech November 28th, this is 1996, the German theologian recalled how some of his own relatives and acquaintances were put to death under the Nazi policy of ridding society of the mentally unfit. As a 14-year-old boy, he watched as Third Reich authorities came to pick up a cousin who had Down syndrome. The cousin, he said, was a few years younger than himself and was a delight to his mother, who had lost her other child. Okay. The cousin was taken to a hospital for better care, the family was told. But shortly afterwards, they learned that he had died from pneumonia, and the body had been cremated. Cardinal Ratzinger recalled that in their village, he and other youngsters liked to visit an elderly spinster who enjoyed the children. But in later years, the woman became overwrought about caring for herself. She was classified as mentally disturbed by the Nazis, taken to a hospital, and died quickly of pneumonia.
Hmm.
Soon after that episode, the state took away three brothers who, despite suffering from mental disturbances, had lived for years in the house next to the Ratzingers. When they, too, were reported as having died so soon afterwards, the whole village realized what was happening. You know, and this happened all over Germany, that people began disappearing. People in nursing homes, in mental facilities, insane asylums, their families began receiving little cards, and they were all dying of pneumonia.
Hmm.
Isn't that something? What a coincidence, you know. And then you'd receive a little thing that would say, if you want the ashes, we'll be happy to send them to you for a donation of so much money. Absolutely insidious. The article finally goes on as Cardinal Ratzinger is talking about this. He said the following, in the final analysis, Cardinal Ratzinger said, human dignity is not something that can be measured scientifically. It must be implicitly recognized in every person, a truth which our own age has promoted. And this is a direct quote from him. Any going back on this, any ideology or political action that puts some human beings outside the category of those who deserve respect would signal a return to barbarism. This is in 1996, and so we certainly see, I think, you know, that whole concept of the culture of death and the culture of life and the great contest of the 20th century, which we're involved in. And when we look at the euthanasia campaign, we see in Nazi Germany, we see, you know, a prototype of so much within our own society. You know, what happens then is that in late 1940, the method of killing people then has changed from using a pistol. What they would do is they would line people up and then walk right behind them, and they would shoot them in the back of the head with this pistol. And that turned out to be too slow, and besides that, it led to the absolute mental breakdown of the people who were doing the killing.
Mm-hmm.
You had to find some kind of a more therapeutic way to kill. And what they came up with then was the use of carbon monoxide. And how they did this was they would, for instance, at Hadamar, they had the facility itself, great big huge old building, where the people were, the mentally ill and the terminally ill, being cared for, sort of a giant hospice kind of a thing. And then one of the SS doctors went over and he took the garage, and he cleaned out the garage, great big huge garage, cleaned it out, and he had it hermetically sealed. The glass was taken out, and metal boards were put in, okay? And then he purchased a submarine motor, a diesel, a big diesel motor from an old World War I submarine, and he had it installed next to the garage so that the people would be, their clothes would be taken off, and they would be given paper gowns, and then they would be walked in, and then the doors would be sealed, and they would turn on that machine, and it would run until everyone died of asphyxiation, and that's how they processed people. And then what they would do is they would take the bodies out, and there was a crematorium right nearby, and then they would cremate the bodies. And it didn't take long before people began realizing that something was going on here, like Cardinal Ratzinger talked about in his own village. And Martin Bormann, one of the top Nazis in Germany at the time, is complained about the poor security that the story was getting out. And finally, he then sent a restriction to all of these killing centers and said, at present, only clear-cut cases of 100% incurables are to be dealt with. Later, there will be extensions. Yeah. It's a poor camouflage,
mm-hmm.
and lots of people are beginning to realize. For instance, I mean, at Hadamar itself, the experience was that you would see a train come in, and then these buses would take these people up to the hill. And at Hadamar, then in the next day or two, there would be all this sweet smoke of human flesh being burned. Night after night, the guards, the orderlies would be going down into Hadamar, drinking themselves silly because of what they were doing. They just couldn't face this.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, while they were getting drunk, they were also telling
stories.
You know, so people, if you didn't want to hear it, you didn't go to the taverns. You
mm-hmm.
know, if you went to the taverns, you were going to hear an earful and know what was going on. Well, by July of 1941, there was enough physical evidence and enough stories, anecdotal stories, that one bishop decided to make the stand. And this is Bishop Clemens von Galen of Münster. It's north central Germany in Westphalia. And on one Sunday, he preached at the cathedral, San Lamberti Cathedral. He preached a sermon against euthanasia. The German term for it is Sterbhilfe, death help. And he was harassed by the Gestapo right afterwards. The Gestapo came in, and you know, so often when you confront these people, what they do is they don't necessarily go after you, they go after somebody else and make an example. And so what the Gestapo did was they went to the Jesuits in Münster and closed down their house and kicked them all out. And he found out about it. And so he and his secretary drove over to the Jesuit house when the Gestapo was there and confronted them. And basically he was roughly treated. And the secretary who has written his the biography of Bishop von Galen, which is just a wonderful story, says that he got back into the car and he had big tears in his eyes. And he turned to the priest who was his secretary, and he said, "Jetzt kann ich nicht mehr schweigen. I can no longer keep quiet." And so after that, every week was another attack on Nazism, on the pagan Nazism, on the lack of human respect for human life. And you know what? The people started turning out like you wouldn't believe. It was so much that they couldn't even fit everybody into the cathedral. They had to put speakers, big loudspeakers outside, so that people were gathering outside for this, for Mass, Clemens von Galen. His sermons were then typed up and mimeographed, sent all over Germany and mimeographed. Of course, this is all illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, they were all distributed throughout Westphalia. And it was mainly done by college students. And the most famous of which is going to be down in Munich. There was an organization, secret organization of basically Catholic students, undergrads at the University of Munich, and some professors, called the White Rose. And these people would risk their lives. Ultimately, they would give their lives, because they would eventually, it was infiltrated, and they were all arrested and then hanged. But there was this network all throughout Germany of getting the message out to people. At one point, the Gestapo finally decided, this is it, we can't deal with this man anymore, and they went and they arrested him. And when they went to the bishop's residence, word got all over the diocese that the Gestapo had come to the bishop. And hundreds of people came to the bishop's residence. And so when, you can imagine this scene, as these two trench-coated Gestapo guys are leading him out to the car, here's Bishop von Galen dressed up in his Episcopal reds, you know. And as he walks out, all of these people are surrounding the car that the Gestapo had come in. And there's this big tussle. And in the end, the crowd grabs the bishop and hauls him back into his house. And then they're pushing and shoving these two Gestapo guys, who eventually made their way to the car. And when they got into the car, they locked themselves in the car. And the crowd is rocking the car back and forth and hollering out, "You both of you are young men. Why aren't you on the Eastern Front?"
Did they make it out alive?
Yes, they made it out alive, but they didn't come back.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that finally on July 30th of 1941, Hitler sent a message to Bishop von Galen, "I'll make a deal with you. You stop preaching, and we won't confiscate any more religious houses in your diocese." Okay. The answer came on August 3rd, when Bishop von Galen came before the people at San Lamberti and preached. And it was even a stronger attack. Basically what he said was, we're in a life-death struggle in this country for the war, the Second World War. And he says, "I can tell you for a fact, we will lose this war because the wrath of God will come upon us because of what we're doing to the defenseless." So that was his response. Once again, all of these things were distributed all the way out. And if that wasn't enough, a copy got all the way to Great Britain. And London Radio broadcast his speech back to Germany.
Wow.
Woof. A week or so later, Hitler has a lot of things on his plate. He's not paying all that much attention to von Galen, but he's paying enough attention. And a week or so later, he was traveling by train from one part of Germany to another, and he came into a railway station, and he noticed that there were hundreds of people gathered there. And he just assumed that the local Gauleiter had found out he was coming, and so he turned out a bunch of people to greet their Führer, you know. Well, that wasn't the case. Actually, it was people who had come down to the train to say goodbye to their loved ones, because they had, like Cardinal Ratzinger, relatives and neighbors and all who were being taken off for therapeutic care. And they knew exactly what was happening now. They knew. Mm-hmm. And so they were tearful. Now, catch the scene. There goes the train with their loved ones. Here comes Hitler's train. And as Hitler saw all these people, he went to the back of the last car so that he could stand out and wave to them and all that. They cursed him. You never hear these stories, but these are people, Germans, in the middle of the Second World War, who cursed the leader of their country, shouting at him, mm-hmm. and cursing him and spitting at him. He was so shocked that he went back into the train car, slumped down in a chair, And he said, that's it. It's over. And then he sent word out. It was on the August 16th, you know, less than 2 weeks after the sermon by Bishop Van Galen, that he sent word all throughout the Third Reich calling off the euthanasia program.
Wow.
And he told privately, he told some of his closest henchmen that when the war is over, I'll deal with Van Galen. But he was afraid to deal with him at that point. That he was afraid that if he did anything specific, that it would lose all the Catholics in Westphalia.
Mm-hmm.
And so he couldn't take that political risk at that point. Isn't that something?
Wow.
Now, here's the interesting thing. Here's how all of this kind of ties in. Because what happens is you have all these SS doctors, you know, and then all of a sudden they're unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, what do you do with them now? And the answer is, they're shifted to the east. Now, by now, World War II is underway. Poland was defeated the first 3 weeks of the war. Poland was then divided up. Half of it was given to Russia, and half of it was given to Germany. Inside of Germany, some of it was incorporated into the Reich, Silesia and the northern Danzig area. There was the center chunk of Germany was put into a very special category called the Generalgouvernement, and it was meant to be administered the same way. And this is Hitler, remember, going back to his youth. Remember what he knew about America? He learned through Karl May. Okay. This was going to be a giant reservation. And instead of having American Indians, he would have Jews and Poles living there. And he would treat them the same way, as he said, as the Americans treated the Indians and basically just starve them to death, to keep them down. And that was going to be his solution, it seemed as though. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the deal was that now the concentration camps in Germany, Austria, other places would be emptied out, and the Jews would be sent off then to the Generalgouvernement, where they would be dealt with. Now you have, by now, you have six centers in that general government, which, by the way, you know, you couldn't visit. This was a restricted area. But there's six centers that were set up, and then the different doctors found themselves employed there. I'll just give you a couple of them. Dr. Mengele,
mm-hmm.
probably the most notorious of all the SS doctors, he goes to Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Thiel, Auschwitz. Horst Schumann goes around from place to place doing human guinea pig experiments. Karl Tiner goes to Mauthausen. He becomes famous for using a giant syringe and injecting people in their heart with air. Otto Struthoff and Hermann Fischer go to Flossenbürg outside of Dachau and set up a killing center there. That's one killing. It's actually a killing center, and it's in Germany. All these other killing centers, you know, the famous ones. Auschwitz-Birkenau, Sobibor, Treblinka, Majdanek, all of these, they're all located in that general government, hidden away. And what happens is then there is a systematic killing of people. Now you have death camps.
Mm-hmm.
You've gone from concentration camps. There are also what they call work camps, where people are worked to death. But the concentration camps themselves are now being set up. But keep in mind that this is all a very secret operation. At one point, Himmler visited the SS in the general government and told them that they were doing a glorious deed, that they were, but that they would not be understood by this present generation. But somewhere, someday down the line, another generation will see the great sacrifice that they're making and recognize them as great heroes. But even there in that speech is recognized the fact that people would not appreciate
mm-hmm.
the hard work that these SS are doing. You know, because what they were doing was absolutely insidious.
Right.
You know, as it goes back to the first chapter of John's Gospel, you know, doing your deeds in dark. You know, this is a perfect example of that. That's why only after the war, and in fact, really in the 1960s and 70s, when we go back and begin reconstructing all of this, we go, oh, well, why didn't anybody do anything about this? Or why wasn't enough done about this? Well, we'll talk about that next time around. We'll look at the dimensions of the Holocaust, the absolutely incredible numbers that are involved in this, and what was done and what was not done, and what was known and what was not known.
Mm-hmm.
Because certainly in 1941, 1942, very little of this is known outside of a very small group within the Nazi Party, and basically it's the SS.
All right.
Yeah.
Wow, Father. Another grim show, but
sorry.
History that, as you say, we need to be very cautious, as it can happen.
Yeah.
Easily.
That's right. And you know, there's every time you go to a concentration camp or any of these cemeteries, you see time after time the symbol, forget it knee, never forget. And we just have to constantly remind ourselves of that, although we constantly forget what happened in Rwanda a couple years ago, what happened in Kosovo, and place after what happened in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And those horrible killings and murders that took place there, and right underneath our noses, we do forget Cambodia. We do forget, but that's one of our big challenges. And I didn't even say anything about this country and the abortion mills.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And where we're sliding with the end of life as well.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
All right. Well, Father, can we close with a prayer and your blessing?
Okay. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you all. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.